Hey folks, this is Rue.
And I'm Dave.
And this is So Many Books.
So Little Time.
And this week, we'll be continuing Ellen Montgomery's Anne of Green Gables, Chapter 2. Cue the music.
So, how are you today, Rue?
I'm good. A little scatterbrained, but good.
That's okay. We're not exactly discussing anything difficult.
Well, they could be difficult things, but it's not as grim. Nothing grim, hopefully.
Grim dark. It's man, kind of... 1984 is so edgy, man. So grim dark.
So grim dark. Well, you know what I mean.
Trying too hard, man.
So bad. Okay. So yes, we are in a slightly more lighthearted territory, as we mentioned. We're continuing with our Anne of Green Gables reading, and it's been so. Last week we had an introduction to Mrs. Rachel Lynde.
Yes.
The
busybody.
The busybody gossip, but with a golden heart. Which is a very strange juxtaposition of concepts.
Hey, well, a trope that was part of American TV was the racist with a heart of gold.
Yeah. Well, she's meddling, but meaningfully meddling, but still, yes. And then we had Marilla, and we had an indication that Matthew Cuthbert is a bit shy, painfully so. If one were to armchair diagnose, probably has something that leads him to being that shy, painfully so.
I like the way where she put it, you know, he usually doesn't want to do anything. So whenever he has an idea that he wants to do, I encourage it. So yes. Even though I'm not fully on board with this idea of his, I thought, well,
why not? And Marilla being the sister who's having this attitude towards Matthew. And we have an idea that Marilla was... Not a beauty, but she was also not plain. She was just kind of that in between, but still.
Oh, and I should say, yeah, Matthew's gone to pick up an orphan.
Yes, and that's considered very shocking. But they went through the reasoning last week and in our last chapter.
And they wanted a boy.
Yes, they definitely don't want a girl because girls, it is known that girls are more likely to poison everyone or whatever. Like, it's a really shocking attitude.
Well, I think also because the kid's about 11 that they wanted to get because they want someone to help out on the farm.
Yeah.
And, yeah, especially physically. With that day, it's the males are the prime candidates for that.
Yes, you wouldn't expect a girl or a woman to be doing a lot of the manly chores.
Mm.
But that's a whole nother topic. So yes. So off we are. And this chapter we're going to actually what we are having is Matthew Cuthbert is surprised.
Yeah, I think I mentioned it last week, but I do like that there are titles for every chapter.
Yeah, the titles are a great little summary of something is going to happen with Matthew this week.
And more of a pleasant one. I don't... There is a literary device that I know Stephen King had really liked to lean on in his later books, but it's the idea, it's foreshadowing, but he uses it in kind of a what's going to happen way. Like, you know, he'll say, and he hung up the phone. Little did he know that was the last time he'd ever speak to his daughter again.
Yes, there was foreshadowing in the last chapter when we had the whole... where Mrs. Rachel was talking to the rose bushes. That's a whole, again, where Mrs. Rachel was talking to the rose bushes out of the fullness of her heart, but could she have seen the child who was waiting patiently at the Bright River station at that very moment, her pity would have been still deeper and more profound.
Mm. It's That's more a tantalizing, what's going to happen, rather than, no, what's happening to the daughter?
Yes. So it gets interesting. So, on that note, we're going to start with chapter 2. Matthew Cuthbert is surprised. Matthew Cuthbert and the sorrel mare jogged comfortably over the 8 miles to Bright River. It was a pretty road running along between snug farmsteads, with now and again a bit of balsamy fir wood to drive through, or a hollow where wild plums hung out their filmy bloom. The air was sweet with the breath of many apple orchards, and the meadows sloped away in the distance to horizon mists of pearl and purple, while the little birds sang as if it were the one day of summer in all the year.
Look how it's printed on mine.
Yes, it's a quote. So this is quoting a poem, which we would have to look up. I really would like footnotes for that, but it's okay. Go back in time and tell Eleanor Montgomery to add footnotes, which probably weren't a thing at the time.
Maybe it was a very famous poem of the time. So it was the idea that, everyone will know where this is from.
Yeah, I'm going to look it up in a minute. But yes, actually, no, why not? Let's go look it up. Boop. Pardon me. It could be a biblical reference. It could be anything. We have no idea right now because it's obscure to us. The Vision of Sir Launfal, James Russell Lowe. Glen Avalon. I'm finding out what's going on. Yes, James Russell Lowe. It is about the Holy Grail and the romancers. And yes, nice.
Kind of echoing the very flowery descriptive language that just
happened. Very pastoral. Mm. There you go. Very pastoral. Pastoral. Anyway. Matthew enjoyed the drive after his own fashion, except during the moments when he met women and had to nod to them. For in Prince Edward Island, you are supposed to nod to all, and sundry you should meet on the road, whether you know them or not. Matthew dreaded all women, except Marilla and Mrs. Rachel. He had an uncomfortable feeling that the mysterious creatures were secretly laughing at him. He may have been quite right in thinking so, for he was an odd-looking personage, with an ungainly figure and long iron-grey hair that touched his stooping shoulders, and a full soft brown beard, which he had worn ever since he was 20. In fact, he had looked at 20 very much as he looked at 60, lacking a little of the greyness. Okay, here's a side note. So the question is, his fear is a genuine phobia. It's not a, it's not a, ew, women are evil and whatever. It's literally women scare me.
I kind of have that with everybody to a small extent. Yeah. I often think people are laughing at me.
As they say, he doesn't really socialize.
Don't prove me right, internet.
Yes. Well, he doesn't socialize, generally speaking, the character. As we were saying, he's a man of very few words. And then you've got this explanation of his thoughts behind it, kind of going, I've got a feeling.
So you were saying...
He was very socially awkward, I think, full stop. And then it's specifically, if you're socially awkward and then on top of that you have association with a gender as being more prone to judging him, possibly.
Well, and you know, that whole men are from Mars, women are from Venus thing.
Yeah, it probably doesn't help. But I mean, the fact that he gets along with Mrs. Lind, of all people...
Well, you know what that might be? That may be one of the few women he actually has like conversations with and interacts with.
Well, not only that, remember Mrs. Lind will not hide her opinion from you.
Mm.
He doesn't have to ask her what she's thinking because she's going to say it.
You know, and that is actually, I would say that's a positive. Even though she's a bit of a gossip and she has her opinions, I kind of appreciate anyone who is completely upfront.
Yeah, well, in this particular case, and she's not malicious. That's the other thing. Like, we've had this last chapter. She's not a malicious person. She is very opinionated and very much the person who wants to be in charge.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, or at least wants to be the one who gives the go-ahead on things.
She wants to feel... maybe she just wants the responsibility. She likes the idea of people relying on her.
Yes. But she's also in a way that she's genuine about it. Whereas he can't, social convention, she's also unusual. And same with Marilla. Those two are unusual characters for the time.
Okay.
That's, I think, what the idea is, that people, you haven't consulted Mrs. Lind. Like, it's kind of unusual that someone would be that central to everything and then not have a hypocritical...
Mm.
But she genuinely, she talks what she walks. She's not a person who doesn't do what she says.
So in a rare occurrence, she may be a gossip who's actually not a backbiter.
Which is unusual, yes.
And by that, of course, I mean the idea of talking about someone maliciously behind their back.
Yeah, it's.
Like, did you hear what happened to her over that house over there?
Yeah, and yeah.
And then when this person leaves, goes over the house, did you hear what happened to him? Oh, he was just at my
Yeah.
place. What he told me. Ooh.
Oh, well, I mean, she probably does like to be the center of the attention there, but at the same time, she's and salacious gossip is interesting to her, but it's more because she wants to be involved in it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, but there did seem to be a bit of that because right after she talked to Marilla, she went further into the town because she had to tell everyone else about it.
Yeah, because it's kind of she lives in a very odd little spot.
So maybe I got that wrong. Maybe the idea of gossip is kind of backbiting and malicious all on its own.
Yeah, the act, I think, yes, I personally also have that feeling that gossiping is backbiting, no matter what the intent is, because you're discussing other people's business with other people, which is
Yeah.
not like short of going, hey, I think it would be good because so and so and so and so are going through a bit of a rough patch if we try to help out a bit more. That's the difference between going through all the nitty-gritty of their business and then having your opinions of it. If they had asked me, I would have said, don't adopt. Which is that's where the ego kicks in. But it's
So,
a
so,
sorry, but it's a hard
so,
topic to navigate, I think. It's a big one.
so maybe at the moment, because also I've just had a chapter with the woman, so I don't feel I really know her
No,
yet.
we're going to get to know these characters a bit better.
But the idea that even though she is gossip, which is primarily a negative thing, she tries to be as open a gossip as she can be.
Yeah, she's very open, it seems, and I think she tries to also not leave herself vulnerable to criticism that is justified. So justified criticism would be, you know, her going and talking about how, oh, Marilla, she never cleans her rug in the front of the
Well,
house, whereas and whilst keeping a home that is whilst if Mrs. Rachel's home was really messy as well, it seems.
and also, I guess there's the thing, if there was a person in a small town who, well, just the idea that if you knew someone was a malicious gossip, you wouldn't be talking to them. Yet
Exactly.
it seems everyone in the town does
Does talk
talk
to
to them.
her, yeah. It's almost, maybe she is the social media of. I'm like, is it Mrs. Rachel Lynde? Facebook, please discuss.
I'm Mrs. Rachel Lynn. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe.
Okay, so sorry, as we continue. So at least he's comfortable with that. So when he reached Bright River, there was no sign of any train. He thought he was too early, so he tied his horse in the yard of a small Bright River hotel and went over to the station house. The long platform was almost deserted, the only living creature in sight being a girl who was sitting on a pile of shingles at the extreme end. Matthew, barely noting that it was a girl, sidled past her as quickly as possible without looking at her. Had he looked, he could hardly have failed to notice the tense rigidity and expectation of her attitude and expression. She was sitting there waiting for something or somebody, and since sitting and waiting was the only thing to do just then, she sat and she waited with all her might and main. Matthew encountered the station master, locking up the ticket office preparatory to going home for supper, and asking him if the 5:30 train would soon be along. The 5:30 train has been in and gone half an hour ago, answered that brisk official. But there was a passenger dropped off for you, a little girl. She's sitting out there in the shingles. I asked her to go into the ladies' waiting room, but she informed me, gravely, that she preferred to stay outside. There was more scope for imagination, she said. She's a case, I should say. I'm not expecting a girl, said Matthew blankly. It's a boy I've come from. He should be here. Mrs. Alexander Spencer was to bring him over from Nova Scotia for me. The station master whistled. I guess there's some mistake, he said. Mrs. Spencer came off the train with that girl and gave her into my charge. Said you and your sister were adopting her from an orphan asylum and that you would be along for her presently. That's all I know about it. And I haven't got any more orphans concealed hereabouts.
So I'm just thinking, especially what this is like 1905 around that.
Yeah.
So there's no There might be telephone in like a city centers and that.
Yeah, telephone is available, but it wouldn't have been a widespread thing. Not like an isolated homestead, particularly one that's not on the main strip of the
Yeah,
road.
so you can't just call up the orphanage and say you've made a mistake. It's pretty much, oh, we're stuck with her, or else we've got to wait weeks to get this all
Well,
sorted
let's we'll see
out.
how it goes. Yeah, it gets messy. I don't understand, said Matthew helplessly, wishing Marilla was at hand to cope with the situation. Well, you'd better question the girl, said the station master carelessly. I dare say she'll be able to explain. She's got a tongue of her own, that's certain. Maybe they were out of boys of the brand you wanted. Oh, that's
Oh.
just could you imagine that attitude? Like, they didn't have the brand of boy you wanted. Like, oh. We're
Okay.
talking about adoption and inclusion of a child.
Well, like from the gossip between Marilla and Mrs. Lynn, it seems that orphans are taken very negatively by
Well,
society at large.
yeah, well, they're like a, but this
Which
is,
actually, to this day.
it's a thing, yeah. But it's almost like a commercial product kind of expression, and that's really disturbing to me. He walked jauntily away, being hungry, and the unfortunate Matthew was left to do that which is harder for him than bearding a lion in its den. Walk up to a girl, a strange girl, an orphan girl, and demand of her why she wasn't a boy. Oh, great.
Why aren't you a boy? I don't know, sir.
That could be a fun conversation. Matthew groaned in spirit as he turned about and shuffled gently down to the platform towards her. She had been watching him ever since he had passed her, and she had her eyes on him now. Matthew was not looking at her and would not have seen what she was really like if he had been. But an ordinary observer would have seen this. A child of about 11, garbed in a very short, very tight, very ugly dress of yellowish-gray wincey. She wore a faded brown sailor hat, and beneath the hat, extending down her back, were two braids of very thick, decidedly red hair. Her face was small, white, and thin, also much freckled. Her mouth was large, and so were her eyes, which looked green in some lights and moods, and gray in others.
So, the red hair and freckles, I'm thinking of Orphan Annie at the moment.
Well,
You
Orphan Annie
think,
came after, so
I
it was
wonder if that
different.
was like almost directly
I
inspired.
would look into that. I wouldn't be surprised
Did
if
we
it
mention
was.
that in episode
We
one?
might have, yeah. I think so. But yes, I mean, she's the first one that we hear about that's.
And the red pigtails also makes me think of the Wendy's hamburger girl.
I also think of what's it called? Pippi Longstocking.
Well, yeah, the Wendy's hamburger girl is kind of a Pippi
Yeah, so it's
Longstocking.
all these things. But yeah, so we're having this. It's interesting that also red hair has got religious connotations in the sense that there's a lot of religious prejudice against red hair, which, by the way, occurs across all populations in the world, not just restricted to those of West European descent. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Side note. So far, the ordinary observer. An extraordinary observer might have seen that the chin was very pointed and pronounced, that the big eyes were full of spirit and vivacity, that the mouth was sweet-lipped and expressive, that the forehead was broad and full. In short, our discerning extraordinary observer might have concluded that no commonplace soul inhabited the body of this stray woman child of whom shy Matthew Cuthbert was so ludicrously afraid. I like the fact that it's like his fear is really not justified, but it is to him.
I don't know, it's always been a thing I kind of like when a when an author, I mean, we're not being cruel towards Matthew, but the author is kind of throwing shade at him.
Yeah. And it's this, it's not even shade that Matthew's a bad person or anything. It's just like going, his fear in this particular instance is especially not needed. Like, it's not a thing.
Well, especially because, I mean, being scared of women is one thing, but like a little 11-year-old girl.
Yeah, it's an interesting fear. But I mean, you don't choose your phobias. Phobias are a
No.
thing. Matthew, however, was spared the ordeal of speaking first. For as soon as she concluded that he was coming to her, she stood up, grasping with one thin brown hand the handle of a shabby old-fashioned carpet bag. The other she held out to him. "I suppose you are Mr. Matthew Cuthbert of Green Gables," she said in a peculiarly clear, sweet voice. "I am very glad to see you. I was beginning to be afraid you weren't coming for me, and I was imagining all the things that might have happened to prevent you. I had made up my mind that if you didn't come back for me tonight, I'd go down the track to that big wild cherry tree at the bend and climb up into it to stay all night. I wouldn't be a bit afraid, and it would be lovely to sleep in a wild cherry tree, all white with bloom in the moonshine, don't you think? You could imagine you were dwelling in marble halls, couldn't you? And I was quite sure you would come for me in the morning if you didn't tonight." Matthew had taken the scrawny little hand awkwardly in his. Then and there he decided what to do. He could not tell his child with the glowing eyes that there had been a mistake. He would take her home and let Marilla do that. It's like, I cannot kill the hope in this child. Let me dub in my sister. Oh, lovely. Oh,
man.
Yeah. She couldn't be left at Bright River anyhow. No matter what mistake had been made, so all questions and explanations might as well be deferred until he was safely back at Green Gables. Notice there, he was safely back at Green Gables. Mm-hmm. He's like, I can't handle not being on the farm. What's going on? "I'm sorry I was late," he said shyly. "Come along, the horse is over in the yard. Give me your bag." "Oh, I can carry it," the child responded cheerfully. "It isn't heavy. I've got all my worldly goods in it, but it isn't heavy. And if it isn't carried in just a certain way, the handle pulls out, so I'd better keep it, because I know the exact knack of it. It is an extremely old carpet bag. Oh, I'm very glad you've come, even if it would have been nice to sleep in a wild cherry tree. We've got to drive a long piece, haven't we? Mrs. Spencer said it was 8 miles. I'm glad, because I love driving. Oh, it seems so wonderful that I'm going to live with you and belong to you. I've never belonged to anybody, not really. But the asylum was the worst. I've only been in it 4 months, but that was enough. I don't suppose you ever were an orphan in an asylum, so you can't possibly understand what it is like. It's worse than anything you could imagine. Mrs. Spencer said it was wicked of me to talk like that, but I didn't mean to be wicked. It's so easy to be wicked without knowing, isn't it? They were good, you know, the asylum people. But there is so little scope for the imagination in an asylum. Only just in the other orphans. It was pretty interesting to imagine things about them. To imagine that perhaps the girl who sat next to you was really the daughter of a belted earl who had been stolen away from her parents in her infancy by a cruel nurse who died before they could confess. I used to lie awake at nights and imagine things like that because I didn't have time in the day. I guess that's why I'm so thin. I am dreadful thin, ain't I? There isn't a pick on my bones. I do love to imagine I'm nice and plump with dimples in my elbows.
I was going to say, even though the next sentence says is that she stopped talking, I'm like, 8 miles of this. And Ruth's going to read it.
Which shy Matthew.
but I can understand it. A girl with an imagination in an asylum finally gets like, oh, someone's going to take care of me.
Hope.
Yep.
Oh, okay, now note, she's only been in the asylum for 4 months. So before that, obviously, she was elsewhere.
Right.
We will find out more. But she's never, but she's also said, I've never belonged to someone. So 4 months she was in the asylum. Before that, that would have been presumably 10 years where she wasn't. But in those 10 years, she's never belonged to someone.
Maybe she was like a street person. They finally caught her and sent her to such a place.
We'll see how that goes. We'll find out more pending. With this, Matthew's companion stopped talking, partly because she was out of breath, and partly because they had reached the buggy. Not another word did she say until they had left the village and were driving down a steep hill, the road part of which had been cut so deeply into the soft soil that the banks fringed with blooming wild cherry trees and slim white birches were several feet above their heads. The child put out her hand and broke off a branch of wild plum that brushed against the side of the buggy. "Isn't that beautiful? What did that tree leaning out from the bank, all white and lacy, make you think of?" she asked. "Well, now I don't know," said Matthew. "Why, a bride, of course. a bride in all white with a lovely misty veil. I've never seen one, but I can imagine what she would look like. I don't ever expect to be a bride myself. I'm so homely, no one will ever want to marry me. I know, it's unless it might be a foreign missionary, I suppose. A foreign missionary mightn't be very particular, but I do hope that someday I shall have a white dress. That is my highest ideal of earthly bliss. I just love pretty clothes, and I've never had a pretty dress in my life that I can remember. But of course, it's all the more to look forward to, isn't it? And then I can imagine that I'm dressed gorgeously. This morning when I left the asylum, I felt so ashamed because I had to wear this horrid old wincey dress. All the orphans had to wear them, you know. A merchant in Hopetown last winter donated 300 yards of wincey to the asylum. Some people said it was because he couldn't sell it, but I'd rather believe that it was out of the kindness of his heart, wouldn't you? It's, look at that mental space of, realistically, it's because he didn't want to, you know, he was not being charitable. It was really not a thing. But he's like, I want to have a charitable thought about this. I'm going to see this way. I'd rather imagine.
Not quite a compartmentalization, but it's like, I know the reality, but then I'm choosing to put a positive spin on it.
Well, I'm choosing to think the best of people. I don't know if you've read Pollyanna. That's another one. Okay, well, the idea
Same
of Pollyanna.
Idea.
Similar. And also a good book, but I think we will have a long time before we touch Pollyanna because you can't have that in Anne of Green Gables in very close proximity. When we got on the train, I felt as if everybody must be looking at me and pitying me. But I just went to work and imagined that I had on the most beautiful pale blue silk dress. Because when you are imagining, you might as well imagine something worthwhile. And a big hat, all flowers, and nodding plumes, and a gold watch, and kid gloves and boots. I felt cheered up right away, and I enjoyed my trip to the island with all my might. I wasn't a bit sick coming over in the boat. Neither was Mrs. Spencer, although she generally is. She said she hadn't time to get sick watching to see that I didn't fall overboard. She said she never saw the beat of me for prowling about. But if it kept her from being seasick, it's a mercy I did prowl, isn't it? And I wanted to see everything that was to be seen on that boat because I didn't know whether I'd ever have another opportunity. Oh, there are a lot more cherry trees all in bloom. This island is the bloomiest place. I just love it already, and I'm so glad I'm going to live here. I've always heard that Prince Edward Island was the prettiest place in the world, and I used to imagine I was living here, but I never really expected I would. It's delightful when your imaginations come true, isn't it? But those red roads are so funny. When we got into the train at Charlottetown and the red roads began to flash past, I asked Mrs. Spencer what made them red, and she said she didn't know, and for pity's sake, not to ask her any more questions.
There can be nothing more exhausting than a curious child.
Well, she's been thirsty for the world, and everything has been in her imagination. So she's like, it's so much, it's hard to believe. She said, I must have asked her 1,000 already. I suppose I had, too. But how are you going to find out about things if you don't ask questions? And what does make the roads red? Well, now, I don't know, said Matthew. Well, that is one of the things to find out sometime. Isn't it splendid to think of all the things there are to find out about? It just makes me glad to be alive. It's such an interesting world. It wouldn't be half so interesting if we know all about everything, would it? There'd be no scope for imagination then, would there? But am I talking too much? People are always...
Well, at least you're self-aware.
Yeah, somewhat. People are always telling me I do. Would you rather I didn't talk? If you say so, I'll stop. I can stop when I make my mind to it, although it's difficult. Matthew, much to his own surprise, was enjoying himself. Like most quiet folks, he liked talkative people when they were willing to do the talking themselves and did not expect him to keep up his end of it. But he had never expected to enjoy the society of a little girl. Women were bad enough in all conscience, but little girls were worse. He detested the way they had of sidling past him timidly with sideways glances, as if they expected him to gobble them up in a mouthful if they ventured to say a word. That was the Avonlea type of well-bred little girl. But this freckled witch was very different. I love it. I'm like going, is he a misogynist? Maybe. Anyway, but not real. I don't know what it is. I think it's he's afraid. He doesn't like how he's judged, not that he's a misogynist about them. He's
but you know, it's that Yoda. It's that Yoda thing where he's afraid of women. Fear leads to anger.
Yes,
and anger at women is misogyny.
Yes, it is. It is still misogyny. It's still misogyny. It's just it's a very odd kind of manifestation of misogyny. It's almost a cultural odd.
I wouldn't even say cultural because remember, he is an oddity.
Yeah, he is an oddity compared to society, which would make him. This is an odd little one. This is a very complicated question, and I'm fascinated.
But I already see. I mean, it may not play out this way, but I see that having. And there will soften him up a bit.
Well, I think it's changed. He's already enjoying himself because he's not, he doesn't feel feared. I think part of it is the fear. Mm. It's fear is begetting anger, which is messy. And I mean, it's fair.
I already am looking forward to the meeting of Anne and Miss Rachel Lynde.
Oh, God, that's going to be interesting. Yeah, it gets fun. So,
but this freckled witch was very different.
But this freckled witch was very different, and although he found it rather difficult for his slower intelligence to keep up with her brisk mental processes, he thought that he kind of liked her chatter. So he said, shyly as usual, "Oh, you can talk as much as you like. I don't mind." "Oh, I'm so glad. I know you and I are going to get along together fine. It's such a relief to talk when one wants to and not be told that children should be seen and not heard. I've had that said to me a million times, and people laugh at me because I use big words. But if you have big ideas, you have to use big words to express them, haven't you?"
Now, I want to interject right there, because this is the complete opposite of what Newspeak.
Yes, I know, we've jumped away from Newspeak. She actually, the eloquence or language or love of language is very much
here. Well, this idea, you know, Newspeak's deliberate purpose was if you remove words, people can't have ideas if they don't have the words to express them.
Yeah, this is
them.
Almost, yeah. This is,
and here she's saying, well, if you want to have big ideas, you have to have big words to express them.
Yeah, that's right. "Well, now, that seems reasonable," said Matthew. "Mrs. Spencer said that my tongue must be hung in the middle, but it isn't. It's firmly fastened at one end. Mrs. Spencer said your place was named Green Gables. I asked her all about it, and she said that there were trees all around it. I was gladder than ever. I just love trees. And there weren't any at all about the asylum, only a few poor weeny-teeny things out in front with little whitewashed cagey things about them. They just looked like orphans themselves, those trees did. It used to make me want to cry to look at them. I used to say to them, 'Oh, you poor little things. If you were out in a great big woods with other trees all around you, and the little mosses and June bells growing over your roots, and a brook not far away, and birds singing in your branches, you could grow, couldn't you? But you can't where you are. I know just exactly how you feel, little trees.'" That is a huge parallel right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she knows.
The asylum was a cage.
The asylum was a cage, but also her life, she can't couldn't flourish. Mm-hmm. But she's like, I know that if I was in the right circumstances, I could flourish.
Yep.
And isn't that a big one?
Yep.
Yeah. "I felt sorry to leave them behind this morning. You do so get attached to things like that, don't you? Is there a brook anywhere near Green Gables? I forgot to ask Mrs. Spencer that. Well, now, yes, there's one right below the house. Fancy. It's always been one of my dreams to live near a brook. I never expected I would, though. Dreams don't often come true, do they? Wouldn't it be nice if they did? But just now I feel pretty nearly perfectly happy. I can't feel exactly perfectly happy because, well, what what color would you call this?"
It's almost an ADD thing. Swirl.
Yeah. She twitched one of her... Well, it's not an ADD thing. She's like going, "I can't feel perfectly happy because... Well, what color would you call this?"
Oh, I read it as more of a, she was going to finish that thought, but then she got distracted. Oh, what color would you call
it? Well, she does kind of squirrel a little bit, but not in this particular case. She's like going, she twitched one of her long glossy braids over her thin shoulders and held it up before Matthew's eyes. Matthew was not used to deciding on the tints of ladies' tresses, but in this case, there couldn't be much doubt. It's red, ain't it? He said. The girl let the braid drop back with a sigh that seemed to come from her very toes, and to exhale forth all the sorrows of the ages. Yes, it's red, she said resignedly. Now you can see why I can't be perfectly happy. Nobody could who has red hair.
Oof.
I know. I don't mind the other things as much, the freckles and the green eyes and my skinniness. I can imagine them away. I can imagine that I have a beautiful rose-leaf complexion and lovely starry violet eyes. But I cannot imagine that red hair away. I do my best. I think to myself, now my hair is a glorious black, black as the raven's wing. But all the time I know it is just plain red, and it just breaks my heart. It will be my lifelong sorrow. I read of a girl once in a novel who had her lifelong sorrow, but it wasn't red hair. Her hair was pure gold, rippling back from her alabaster brow. What is an alabaster brow? I never could find out. Can you tell me? Well, now I'm afraid I can't, said Matthew, who was getting a little dizzy. He felt as he had once felt in his rash youth, when another boy had enticed him on the merry-go-round at a picnic. Well, whatever it was, must have been something nice, because she was divinely beautiful. Have you ever imagined what it must be like to be divinely beautiful? Well, now, no, I haven't, confessed Matthew ingenuously. I have often. Which would you rather be if you had the choice? Divinely beautiful, or dazzlingly clever, or angelically good? Well, now, I don't know exactly. Neither do I. I can never decide. But it doesn't make a real difference, for it isn't likely I'll be either. It is certain I'll never be angelically good. Mrs. Spencer says, Oh, Mr. Cuthbert! Oh, Mr. Cuthbert! Oh, Mr. Cuthbert! That was not what Mrs. Spencer had said. Neither had the child tumbled out of the buggy, nor had Matthew done anything astonishing. They had simply rounded a curve in the road and found themselves in the avenue. The avenue, so called by the Newbridge people, was a stretch of road 400 or 500 yards long, completely arched over with huge, wide-spreading apple trees, planted years ago by an eccentric old farmer. Overhead was one long canopy of snowy, fragrant bloom. Below the boughs, the air was full of a purple twilight, and far ahead a glimpse of painted sunset sky shone like a great rose window at the end of a cathedral aisle. Its beauty seemed to strike the child dumb. She leaned back in the buggy, her thin hands clasped before her, her face lifted rapturously to the white splendor above. Even when they had passed out and were driving down the long slope to Newbridge, she never moved or smoked. Yep. Elon Musk meme.
Oh, man, a Green Gables.
Her face lifted rapturously to even when they were, I'm finding it. She never moved or spoke. Still with rapt face, she gazed afar into the sunset west, with eyes that saw visions trooping splendidly across that glowing background. Through Newbridge, a bustling little village where dogs barked at them and small boys hooted and curious faces peered from the windows, they drove, still in silence. When 3 more miles had dropped away behind them, the child had not spoken. She could keep silence, as it was evident, as energetically as she could talk. I guess you're feeling pretty tired and hungry, Matthew ventured to say at last, accounting for her long visitation of dumbness with the only reason he could think of. But we haven't very far to go now, only another mile. She came out of her reverie with a deep sigh and looked at him with the dreamy gaze of a soul that had been wandering afar, star-led. Oh, Mr. Cuthbert, she whispered, that place we came through, that white place, what was it? Well, now you must mean the avenue, said Matthew, after a few moments' profound reflection. It's kind of a pretty place. Pretty? Oh, pretty doesn't seem the right word to use, nor beautiful either. They don't go far enough. Oh, it was wonderful, wonderful. It's the first thing I ever saw that couldn't be improved upon by imagination.
Aww.
It just satisfies me here. She put one hand on her breast. It made a queer, funny ache, and yet it was a pleasant ache. Do you ever have an ache like that, Mr. Cuthbert? Well, now I just can't recollect that I ever had. I had it lots of times. Whenever I see anything royally beautiful. But they shouldn't call that lovely place the Avenue. There's no meaning in a name like that. They should call it, let me see, the White Way of Delight. Isn't that a nice imaginative name? When I don't like the name of a place or a person, I always imagine a new one. Oh my God. I always imagine a new one and always think of them so. There was a girl at the asylum whose name was Hepzibah Jenkins, but I always imagined her as Rosalia DeVere. Other people may call that place the Avenue, but I shall always call it the White Way of Delight. Have we really only got another mile to go before we get home? I'm glad and I'm sorry. I'm sorry because this drive has been so pleasant, and I'm always sorry when pleasant things end. Something still pleasanter may come after, but you can never be sure. Wow, that gives you a real indication of her life.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's really why we can't appreciate good things when they're happening.
Sometimes, yeah, it's hard to sometimes. That's been my experience anyhow. But I'm glad to think of getting home. You see, I've never had a real home since I can remember. It just gives me that pleasant ache again just to think of coming to a really truly home. Oh, isn't that pretty? They had driven across the crest of a hill. Below them was a pond, looking almost like a river, so long and winding was it. A bridge spanned it midway, and from there to its lower end, where an amber-hued belt of sand hills shut it in from the dark blue gulf beyond. The water was a glory of many shifting hues, the most spiritual shadings of crocus and rose and ethereal green, with other elusive tintings which for which no name has ever been found. I like the way that it was expressed there. Like, you can't, it's beyond description.
Although it's funny because I've read so many books where, like, the author is, well, the character in the book, is like, I know it's bad form to call something indescribable, but that's what it was. But to their credit, most times when I've come across that, then the character goes, but I'm going to try.
Yeah, and I think they've tried to describe it, and they're going kind of going, it's beyond, like, it's that moment of all these colors that you can't even put a name to. There's just so many.
Because the cynical, response is, it's your job as an author to describe the indescribable.
That is true. Above the bridge, the pond ran up into fringing groves of fir and maple, and lay all darkly translucent in their wavering shadows. Here and there, a wild plum leaned out from the bank like a white-clad girl tiptoeing to her own reflection. From the marsh at the head of the pond came the clear, mournfully sweet chorus of the frogs. There was a little grey house peering around a white apple orchard on a slope beyond, and although it was not yet quite dark, a light was shining from one of its windows. "That's Barry's Pond," said Matthew. "Oh, I don't like that name either. I shall call it, let me see, the Lake of Shining Waters. Yes, that is the right name for it. I know because of the thrill. When I hit on a name that suits exactly, it gives me a thrill. Do things ever give you a thrill?" Matthew ruminated. "Well, now yes. It always gives me a thrill to see them ugly white grubs that spade up in the cucumber beds. I hate the look of them." "Oh, I don't think that can be exactly the same kind of thrill. Do you think it can?" "There doesn't seem to be much connection between grubs and lakes of shining waters, does there? But why do other people call it Barry's Pond?" Wait for it.
Yep.
"I reckon because Mr. Barry lives up there in that house. Orchard Slope's the name of his place. If it wasn't for that big bush behind it, you could see Green Gables from here. But we have to go over the bridge and around by the road, so it's nearly half a mile further. Has Mr. Barry any little girls? Well, not so very little either. About my size. He's got one about 11. Her name is Diana." Oh, with a long indrawing of breath. "What a perfectly lovely name. Well, now, I don't know. There's something dreadful heathenish about it, seems to me. I'd rather Jane or Mary or some sensible name like that. But when Diana was born here, was born there, was a schoolmaster boarding there, and they gave him the naming of her, and he called her Diana. I wish there had been a schoolmaster like that around when I was born then. Oh, here we are at the bridge. I'm going to shut my eyes tight. I'm always afraid of going over bridges. I can't help imagining that perhaps just as we get to the middle, they'll crumple up like a jackknife and nip us. So I shut my eyes, but I always have to open them for all when I think that we're getting near the middle. Because, you see, if the bridge did crumple up, I'd want to see it crumple. What a jolly rumble it makes. I always like the rumble part of it. Isn't it splendid that there are so many things to like in this world? Listen to that. There, we're over. Now I'll look back. Good night, dear lake of shining waters. I always say good night to the things I love, just as I would to people. I think they like it. That water looks as if it was smiling at me. Wow. So another thing is like that loneliness that to that point where the inanimate becomes, you know. When they had driven up the further hill and around a corner, Matthew said, "We're pretty near home now. That's Green Gables over." "Oh, don't tell me," she interrupted breathlessly, catching at his partially raised arm and shutting her eyes that she might not see his gesture. "Let me guess. I'm sure I'll guess right." She opened her eyes and looked about her. They were on the crest of a hill. The sun had set some time since, but the landscape was still clear in the mellow afterlight. To the west, a dark church spire rose up against a marigold sky. Below was a little valley, and beyond, a long, gently rising slope with snug farmsteads scattered along it. From one to another, the child's eyes darted, eager and wistful. At last, they lingered on one away to the left. Far back from the road, dimly white with blossoming trees in the twilight of the surrounding woods. Over it, the stainless southwest sky, a great crystal white star was shining like a lamp of guidance and promise. "That's it, isn't it?" she said, pointing. Matthew slapped the reins on the sorrel's back delightedly. "Well, now you've guessed it. But I reckon Mrs. Spencer described it so as you could tell." "No, she didn't, really, she didn't. All she said might just as well have been about most of those other places. I hadn't any real idea what it looked like, but just as soon as I saw it, I felt it was home. Oh, it seems as if I must be in a dream. You know, my arm must be black and blue from the elbow up, for I've pinched myself so many times today. Every while a horrible, sickening feeling would come over me, and I'd be so afraid it was all a dream. Then I'd pinch myself to see if it was real. Until suddenly I remembered that even supposing it was only a dream, I'd better go on dreaming as long as I could. So I stopped pinching. But it is real, and we're nearly home. My God, that's heartbreaking.
Well, this whole chapter so far, all her talk, I've been like, oh, her wee heart is going to break.
Yeah. Well, it gives us a really, like, I think that is part of it. Like, we need to witness just what's going on because you can see how this and then Marilla. Marilla's very practical, very pragmatic, very.
Although, because Matthew's enjoying himself the way I see this going, she's like, oh, well, we'll get this sorted out and send her back. And then Matthew's like, you know what? I'd like to keep her.
So let's see how this goes. With a sigh of rapture, she relapsed into silence. Matthew stirred uneasily. He felt glad that it would be Marilla and not he who would have to tell this waif of the world that the home she longed for was not to be hers after all. I know, I'm like, oh. They drove over Lynn's Hollow, where it was already quite dark, but not so dark that Mrs. Rachel could not see them from her window vantage. And up the hill into the long lane of Green Gables. By the time they arrived at the house, Matthew was shrinking from the approaching revelation with an energy he did not understand. It was not of Marilla or himself he was thinking, of the trouble this mistake was probably going to make for them, but of the child's disappointment. When he thought of that rapt light being quenched in her eyes, he had an uncomfortable feeling that he was going to assist at the mur at murdering something, much the same feeling that came over him when he had to kill a lamb or calf or any other innocent little creature. That description right there, it's like the yard was quite dark as they turned into it, and the poplar leaves were rustling silkily all around it. "Listen to the trees talking in their sleep," she whispered, as he lifted her to the ground. "What nice dreams they must have." Then, holding tightly to the carpet bag which contained all her worldly goods, she followed him into the house.
And everyone listening, I am right there with you. I don't want us to stop right now because I want to see how this continues. What happens.
Yes. But yeah, it's a she's such a vibrant character. You can see why Mark Twain just adores her.
I mean, you've talked about how there are those who don't like the later books because of certain hardships that happen to the characters. And I mean, obviously, as part of the book is going to be her growing up and learning to deal with the hardships of life and blunt some of that optimism off her. But hopefully it doesn't change her because
there's one particular event that happens. Two events that happen eventually when she's older that were very painful. But she's already been through so much hardship, and how she copes with that.
Well, that's the amazing thing. Yeah. We don't know her backstory. Well, you do, but I don't know her backstory yet. And for an orphan to be that optimistic and happy and looking for the best in people, I mean, you know, she is an 11-year-old girl as well.
Yeah. To manage to have retained that.
So much so that, you know, it really was that buildup of, oh, she's going to be so crushed.
Yeah.
So crushed.
This is not going to end well. But we don't know if it's going to end well. But yeah, it's not going to be a pleasant. The next chapter is going to be challenging, I think is the word.
I am going to be very interested to see Marilla's reaction.
Well, I think we have little hints that have been dropped, like little breadcrumbs that she will be an outsider, not just because she's coming from outside the village, but her character is completely different to the little girls of the village.
Yeah.
Who are very much be quiet.
Who Matthew does not like.
Yeah. Because, well, they hide and they act in fear. Whereas she has been through things. Her fear is more, my dreams, like she said, dreams very rarely become true.
But wouldn't it be great if they did?
Yeah, that kind of completely different approach, which...
And I'm sorry.
No, you're right. Please.
Because I was thinking, you know, sometimes it was a bit much, her response to the white apple orchard.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the kind of person she's obviously is. And I think we have met people where their enthusiasm for certain things was a bit too much. But
yeah, well, I mean, all of us will have things that we're particularly enthusiastic about. I think what it is that for her, she's just gone, this is the first time I've seen something where I didn't have to use my imagination to imagine it
that
better.
That was a great line.
Yeah, it's this idea of, we had it, her hair color is the one thing she can't imagine away.
Oh, that made me so sad.
I know, I'm like going, she can imagine her eyes being a different color that's more acceptable to society, or that is considered beauty. So it's interesting, she's aware of the beauty standards that society places upon them, because probably it's been emphasized to her that she is the antithesis of that.
Yeah, she's too thin, she's got freckles, she's got...
red hair.
Has green eyes not been a nice thing?
Well, it's not blue eyes, is it? Or brown? It's that weird in between.
Okay, so brown and blue are the...
Acceptable
ones. I've never thought about eye color as something... aside from the idea that, you know, the whole blonde hair, blue eyes is like the...
the one of the things. Well, what it is, I mean, you can see she wanted black hair. Black hair is not what you would expect, but no, it's the ideals that, for example, Snow White and...
If she lived 100 years later, she could have the black hair she wants.
No, but the idea is that she is a redhead.
Yeah.
And by their very rarity, by the fact that it's rarer to have red hair and green eyes, and those things are rare, that makes her stand out and not in a...
But maybe it's the standing out that has given her that complex that these things aren't beautiful.
Well, also society tends to look at it a little askance. And we're talking early 1905 and stuff. There are certain prescriptive ideas of beauty. Tennyson would have had a certain style. Like, there's things that historically are emphasized as beautiful in literature, whereas mentioning red hair as a sign of beauty would not be a thing, because you also have a heavy influence of the idea. I mean, someone is most likely going to research this and make better comments on it, but I know that red hair has got some negative associations with it, as do freckles, as do...
And red hair and freckles usually go together.
They're more frequent. Yeah, it's a genetics thing.
But even the thinness, how she lamented her thinness, which made me think maybe in 1905 it was still that idea where if you had some meat on you, it showed that you were able to eat.
Yeah, dimples. I think 1905, that's Queen Victoria's time, if I'm not mistaken. I'm going to double check that one. I think it's Queen Victoria's time, or her son. 1905.
And maybe the idea of being, especially having a thin child, is like, oh, this girl's not been fed.
Yeah, it's a sign of poverty. Queen Victoria. No, it was Edward. Time of Edward. We are in the Edwardian time. But yeah, even then, being thin was... I mean, they're coming out of the time of Queen Victoria, where a bit more pudginess was a thing.
And isn't it interesting how it seems throughout history there's been that waves of fat is good, and at the moment we're in an idea that no, fat is unhealthy.
There's a lot of assumptions made based on whether someone is fat or not fat, or what, like our relationship with appearance is very odd. Like there's if you look up beauty standards in the Edwardian period, which is what I just did, a lot of them have dark hair.
Okay.
Is a couple of blondes.
How can you tell? Those are black and white pictures.
No, you can tell by the...
If it's fair.
If it's fair.
They could be brunettes. Fair brunettes.
There's the Gibson girl. It's apparently the personification of feminine attraction.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Why is she called the Gibson girl?
I'm figuring it out. Gibson girl is an image that appeared in the 1890s. This is the American perspective.
Okay.
So we're going to focus. The idea of...
And I'm guessing in 1905, the American perspective might have been similar to the Canadian perspective.
Yeah. It would. I mean, they're going to have more of a British influence, but still. So I'm just reading Wiki.
Yeah.
I'm reading Wiki because... Yeah. So the Gibson girl image that appeared in the 1890s combined elements of older American images of contemporary female beauty, such as the fragile lady and the voluptuous woman. From the fragile lady, she took the basic slender lines and a sense of respectability. From the voluptuous woman, she took on a large bust and hips, but was not vulgar or lewd, as previous images of women with large busts and hips had been depicted. So this is an artistic the image. Right.
Curves, but not too much curve.
Yeah. She had an exaggerated S-curve torso achieved by wearing of a swan bill corset. Man, those spines would not be happy.
No.
So images of her epitomize the late 19th and early 20th preoccupation with youthful features and ephemeral beauty. Her neck was thin and her hair piled high upon her head in the contemporary bouffant pompadour and chignon. This me doing French accent is really bad. I know. The statuesque, narrow-waisted ideal of feminine figure was portrayed as being at ease and stylish. So yeah, upper-middle-class society, perfectly dressed in the latest fashionable attire.
So Mrs. Lynde and Marilla Cuthbert, they're older women.
Yes.
But I can't quite remember their descriptions.
One is a bit tall and a bit more sharp.
Maybe we'll meet someone in Green Gables that's like in her 20s or 30s.
Yeah, we're gonna see more and more in terms of, but yeah, this,
and we'll see how they're, because I imagine if you live in a small village where a lot of people are farming, the beauty standards of like a city will not apply because
as much,
these women are working.
Yeah, they'll be in a different. I think that's the idea. It's interesting to observe that she is aware, at even that young age at 11, is aware of what is and isn't considered by society as beautiful. I mean, that's a great commentary on this actually being a thing.
Yeah, it's already given her a negative self-image.
Yeah, which, I mean, the fact that this is covered in a book that was written in 1905 should be a really big indicator that this hasn't stopped. This is a thing.
In a lot of ways, it's gotten worse.
It's become more commercialized, like it's been exploited much more.
Well, because the ideal beauty is now in our faces everywhere because of advertising.
It's advertising, it's products that are sold. I mean, then it would have also been, I mean, the Victorian age, they used to sell arsenic pills, and other things to try and make you look or appear a certain way. But they were wearing corsets. So.
In every era, women have killed themselves for beauty
Yeah,
standards.
and they've been told what beauty standards applied by people who want to sell them products.
Capitalism ho.
Yo. Anyway, so it definitely a complicated, but it's fascinating that this is actually addressed or not addressed.
It's a part of her character.
It's part of her character in the sense that it's been woven into the story and not in a very subtle, but it's still there. It's very obvious, and it becomes a running theme in terms of her relationship with her hair is a big one. I mean, you can tell it's the one thing she cannot use her imagination to imagine away. She can deal with the fact that she's an orphan. Well, deal. She can use her imagination to cope with the fact that she is an orphan, that she's not in good circumstances, that she's never. She sees those poor little trees. Like she can respond with deep empathy and deep compassion, even towards herself to a certain extent. But when it comes to that one feature, it's hard for her because it's obviously been something that's been a sore point that others have raised.
And well, even her other features, she still uses her imagination to change them.
Yeah. So for her, she isn't good enough because she's told she isn't good enough because this is what is good enough and what you are not. And I mean that ex is you can imagine. So there's a Netflix series. The Netflix series that they have is not the same as it's not as true to the book. But it's doing what we're doing here, which is reading between the lines. And it did depict an interpretation of what's going on between the lines. Depicts, like she said, those 4 months in the orphanage were awful. Awful. Those
Orful orphanages.
4 months in that orphanage were awful, right? In this series, we get little glimpses of why it was awful.
In the books, do you?
It doesn't really get mentioned that much. Like it does come up. But very tiny, like barely mentioned. It's just kind of not glossed over as much as you can tell it's been traumatizing to her, but she's managed to push it away.
Just the way she is there, her resilience for what has obviously been quite a hard life is quite commendable.
The fact that she's never belonged, she's never felt loved, she's never felt cared for. Like in an emotional sense, like she probably has had food on her plate and a roof over her head,
Maybe.
maybe. But other than that, she still manages to think charitable things about
Very much.
people who might not deserve it. So yeah, she's definitely she's inspiring in the sense of it is a fictitious character.
Well, I already like her.
Yeah, she's very likable in that sense. Occasionally you want to just go, no, don't do that. But
Well, she is also a
she's
child.
also a child, yes. You gotta go, wait, she's 11. She's 11.
Maybe someone like Mrs. Lind can help straighten her out. Or they'll butt heads.
you can see how it's going to be an interesting combination of people.
Well, I mentioned in the first chapter how just the way what's the author's name again? Sorry, I'm very bad.
Lucy Maud Montgomery. Ellen Montgomery. Montgomery.
Miss Montgomery, I'll say.
Mrs.
Mrs. Montgomery, she's I'll just say Montgomery because I refer
Yeah.
to male authors by their last name only.
Exactly.
How Montgomery describes characters less with I don't remember the physical descriptions, I remember kind of the behavioral
Yeah.
descriptions.
She's very good at that painting that picture. She can. I mean, she did describe Anne like to the ordinary
Well,
observer.
the only reason I remember Anne's description is because there was that link to how much she dislikes her own appearance.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can't, I only remember kind of the kind of I guess it's just the idea that so far we've met four characters and I get a good sense of all of them and I look forward to seeing how they interact. And as this is called Anne of Green Gables, I have the feeling we're going to get that same insight into almost every member of the town. So there's potential for a lot of great character interaction.
Yeah, and growth. I mean, we already get an idea also about what's it called? Mrs. Stewart. No, not Stewart, Mrs. Spencer. How she's like long on that turn. She's like not really capable of coping with what is Anne. Anne is very intense for her, very difficult
Well,
for
she's
her.
also got to look after her orphanage.
Yeah, well, she was well bringing people across from the orphanage. So yes, very fascinating.
So, shall we wrap up?
Yeah. So with that, we are wrapping up chapter two. Next week we will have chapter three. And the music at the top of the show was from the soundtrack to a rather famous Canadian miniseries of Anne of Green Gables, which is called Avonlea by Haygood Hardy.
At the end of the episode, as always, I'm the slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me on Twitter at Dave underscore the underscore turnip.
And you can find me on Twitter at the same with Rue McMoo. Roomcmoo, but also so many books all the time, so that's
SMBSLT podcast on both Facebook and Twitter. We have a Facebook page. We have a what's the word?
Facebook group as well.
Dedicated Twitter account for the podcast.
Yes.
And we're, oh, should we mention that we officially launched as of the recording?
Ah, yes, we have officially launched as of this recording. We are now we have launched and we are 2 weeks into it. So if you haven't yet by now, please drop a review, give feedback, interact with
We're
us.
pretty much on everything now. We're listed on iTunes. We're on Google. We're on Stitcher.
Yeah, Spreaker.
We're hosted on Wooshka, and you can listen to it there as well.
Yep, there's a you have many, many options to listen. And with feedback, you're probably better off with Twitter, with Facebook, and with
Yeah,
iTunes.
we'd love to see some discussion in the Facebook group,
Yeah.
or Rue would.
Well, yes. I can see that, and then I share it all with Dave, so it works.
So until next week, when we'll be continuing Anne of Green Gables, which I'm very much enjoying. It's such a refreshing change of pace.
It is fun. I stumble across some of the expressions whilst we're recording, which of course Dave edits out. But that is because the language is it's a little it's not common everyday language.
As you get into the head of the character, you'll learn.
Yes, it's good.
I kind of learned to inhabit Winston and O'Brien and
You get
all
that?
the other characters
Yeah.
of
So bear in mind, it will get more smooth and more comfortable.
But
But
yeah.
yes, till next time, I'm Rue.
I'm Dave, and happy reading, everybody.
Bye.